Sponsorship for this KQED live audio stream comes from Brevo, a customer relationship management platform that can help engage with clients across email, SMS, WhatsApp, and more. For more information, visit brevo.com. That's brevo.com.
Good morning. This is the California Report. I'm Adi Bolaños in San Francisco. LA County is ramping up its distribution of monkeypox vaccines, and it's also expanding its list of who can get the shots. As KPCC senior health reporter Jackie Fortier reports, LA's approach is different from other parts of the country.
New York City and Washington, D.C. are offering shots to any high-risk adult who wants one, including men who have sex with men. L.A. County is taking a more targeted approach. The county's current batch of 6,000 doses will only be available to people with monkeypox, their close contacts, and high-risk people recommended by their health provider. That's partly because of a limited supply of vaccine.
I think here in L.A. County, what's different is we really want to ensure that we're able to offer the vaccine in an equitable way for those at highest risk of monkeypox.
Andrea Kim runs the county's vaccination program. She says sexual health clinics will offer the shots to certain high-risk patients across the county.
They know their clientele, so we really want to be working with them to integrate the vaccine into their routine clinical care.
Monkeypox usually spreads through close contact. Symptoms include a fever, aches, and a rash with painful pustules. So far, LA County has more than 50 probable or confirmed cases. No one has died here from the disease. For the California Report, I'm Jackie Fortier in Los Angeles.
Thousands of tenants who were denied pandemic rent relief may soon get a second chance. KQED's Aaron Baldessari reports a judge in Alameda County last week ordered the state to temporarily stop issuing denials and to hold off on finalizing many others.
As of June 23rd, the state had denied close to 160,000 applications for emergency rental assistance, according to the research group PolicyLink. That's about a third of all applications. The state's Department of Housing and Community Development says it always gives a reason for denials, but tenant advocates say those reasons are often vague and confusing, which makes it hard to appeal. And a judge agreed. Madeline Howard is an attorney with the Western Center on Law and Poverty.
We're hopeful that the tenants who benefit from this order will be able to get these unfair denials reversed and get access to the rental assistance that they need to stay in their homes.
A statewide moratorium on evictions for people waiting on rent relief expired on July 1st. But Howard says many people are still protected under local moratoriums, including in Alameda County, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. Howard says tenants who've been denied rent relief should reach out to the state hotline.
Reaching out to the hotline will hopefully allow you to get more information about why you're being denied so you can figure out if there's other documents that you need to submit or other steps that you need to take.
The next hearing in the case is scheduled for August. For the California Report, I'm Aaron Baldessari.
The Washburn Fire has now doubled in size in the historic Yosemite National Park. More than 2,000 acres have burned, and firefighters are working in difficult terrain to protect some of the largest and oldest redwood trees in the world. Residents and campers near the fire have been evacuated, and thick smoke has worsened the region's air quality and obscured the park's scenic views. The fire, which started on July 7th, threatens at least 500 giant sequoias in the Mariposa Grove. Sticking to wildfires, a federal judge has ordered the National Park Service to halt a tree removal operation meant to prevent severe wildfires in Yosemite National Park. Last week's order came after an environmental organization, the Earth Island Institute, sued the national park. The organization says the Park Service failed to provide proper public notice or assess environmental risks. LA Times reporter Felicia Alvarez has been covering the issue.
Part of the Earth Island Institute's argument was a letter that over 200 scientists signed on to last year, urging Congress and the Biden administration to really turn away from these forest thinning and logging projects for fire management and to go with other proposals like prescribed burns instead.
Prescribed burns across the state have been delayed by a lack of people certified to run them. In other news, California has some pretty great bridges. The California Report's Saul Gonzalez tells us about one of the newest additions.
Over the weekend, the new 6th Street Viaduct opened in Los Angeles, connecting the city's Boyle Heights neighborhood with downtown. Costing more than $500 million to build and 3,500 feet in length, it's the largest and most expensive bridge project in the history of L.A. The span replaces an older bridge built in the 1930s that engineers feared could collapse in an earthquake. Now, along with getting people from point A to point B, the new bridge is also designed to be an architectural showstopper. Crossing over a freeway, surface streets, rail lines, and the LA River, the bridge features 10 pairs of enormous arches that tilt out from the main deck and are illuminated at night by thousands of LED lights, creating a ribbon of light effect. City Councilman Kevin De Leon represents the area where the 6th Street Viaduct is located and predicts the bridge will become an instant LA icon.
Well, this is going to be, without a doubt, another iconic symbol of LA. You have Hollywood sign up on the hills. You have the Griffith Observatory. This 6th Street Bridge will be iconic, not just for LA and the country, but throughout the world. This is going to be a bridge for the people.
As for criticisms, although there are generous spaces for pedestrians and cyclists on the bridge, cycling advocates say its bike lanes should offer more protections for cyclists. There are also worries that the bridge could increase gentrification in LA's East Side neighborhoods. Looking ahead, there are plans to put a 12-acre park under the bridge. For the California Report, I'm Saul Gonzalez in Los Angeles.
With most parts of California experiencing a drought, KCRW's Kaylee Wells tells us how LA County is dealing with its watering restrictions.
The drought restrictions that began last month in Southern California target water districts that rely heavily on water imported from Northern California. Santa Monica used to be among them, but now less than half of their water is imported.
But that doesn't mean we're just sitting around doing nothing. We're looking at increasing our conservation efforts.
Santa Monica's water resources manager, Sunny Wang, is standing at a treatment plant a block from the ocean. He points to a storm drain across the street.
Over there. So it actually diverts dry weather runoff from that storm drain. We bring it here for treatment. That produces non-potable water for irrigation and recycling.
This treatment plant can process 500,000 gallons every day on rainy days. And since rain is a little sparse these days, Wang says the city needed to start using salt water, too.
Upgrade, we also installed a saline infiltration gallery over on the other side of the pier to fully utilize the treatment capacity here when stormwater and urban runoff isn't that available.
Santa Monica is on track to drop their reliance on imported water from about 50% in 2013 to just 10% next year. And there's more good news. Local water is cheaper than imported water. Wang says Santa Monica water bills are 20 to 40% lower than nearby cities.
But if you look at the long run, the 10, 20, 30 years out, we're going to be way under the imported water costs historically.
Why isn't every city doing this? Well, for one thing, Santa Monica is a beachside city, so they have more access to saline water. And yes, the ratepayers will pay back the loans that are helping with the $200 million worth of projects, but the water agency also had the money up front because Santa Monica is a relatively affluent city. So for Santa Monica, more local water is nice to have. For another city in LA County, it's all they have. Catalina Island is no stranger to drought. The 4,000 people living there are so remote that importing water isn't an option. So when water in the local reservoir becomes scarce, there is no plan B. Mayor Annie Marshall has lived on Catalina for 37 years. She says in the last drought, the reservoir got down to about 10% full.
Most of us don't have yards, so basically we sacrificed by reducing our personal water consumption by 40%.
Marshall would stand over a bucket when she showered and use the runoff to water her plants. She says it meant fewer showers and loads of laundry.
Well, now the tables have kind of turned. I feel so bad for the state of California, but I'm very happy for Catalina Island. Is we have two desal plants.
The desalination plants turn about 250,000 gallons of salt water into fresh water each day, which is about 40% of the island's water demand. Brian Leventhal works for Southern California Edison, which operates the plants.
Before we relied heavily on desal, Catalina used to be the first in going into drought restrictions. Now that we rely so heavily on desal production, we're at the back of the pack.
They're about to enter level one restrictions, which is a 10% mandatory water reduction. It's a far cry from the 35% that some Southern Californians are facing. On top of that, most of the toilets on Catalina are salt water. Some of the fire hydrants spit out salt water. And desal is so popular there, they're working on adding another saltwater well to make more water at the plants.
It's completely drought resistant, as opposed to groundwater resources, which require rain.
Meanwhile, desalination isn't as popular on the mainland. It's very expensive, and it can kill nearby marine life depending on how the water is piped in. The Catalina groundwells pull water through the sand as a natural filter. Less water treated, but also fish aren't getting trapped. Marshall says most residents agree expensive water is better than no water at all.
We're all tickled to death that we have it, or we would be looking at what the rest of the state is looking at.
As the entire state contemplates its drier future, the pressure is on to overcome financial and environmental obstacles and invest in local water. Miles inland, Riverside County's city of Menifee just unveiled its third desal plant, and a proposed desal plant on Doheny Beach could earn approval next year. For the California Report, I'm Kaylee Wells in Los Angeles.
And finally, there are plenty of anecdotes about friends and neighbors packing up and leaving California. But a new report provides some evidence to back up claims of a Golden State exodus. Researchers looked at moving patterns over the last several years, including during the pandemic. They found that outflow of Californians remained consistent. KCRW's Matt Gillum has the details.
A good way to track moves is to look at information from moving companies, and that's exactly what the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago did. They crunched data from United Van Lines and tracked migration patterns both before and during the pandemic. Whether it was a time prior to any of us being familiar with social distancing or well into the COVID era, the top state-to-state move, according to the Chicago Fed study, was from California to Texas. The next most popular destination for Golden State residents, again both pre- and post-pandemic, was Washington. Interestingly, California to Florida jumped from the fifth largest state-to-state move pre-COVID to the third biggest after the health crisis set in. The analysis shows California consistently remained a state with more outbound migration between 2018 and 2021, with the percentage of moves away from the Golden State slightly ticking up after the onset of the pandemic. As for conclusions, the researchers say they're leaving what may have motivated the moves up to others. They point out that Postal Service data shows requests for a temporary change of address notably rose between February and July of 2020, which could indicate not all of the pandemic-era moves were permanent. For the California Report, I'm Matt Gillum.
And that's the California Report for Monday, July 11th. We're a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Andy Bolaños. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Support for the California Report comes from Personal Capital, providing people with financial tools like the Retirement Planner to help them achieve their financial goals. PersonalCapital.com. Stanford Healthcare, alerting listeners to the critical blood shortage in the area. Now is the time to donate blood and make a difference. StanfordBloodCenter.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working together to create a just world where all people have access to renewable energy, clean air and water, and healthy food. On the web at theschmidt.org.